to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien, who's also your host for this continuing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Bob Kincaid, I want to thank you very much for that introduction, and welcome to another week of the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. We have gone beyond the midpoint of July. We have gone beyond the midpoint of the calendar year 2015. Today is the 20th day of July in the year 2015. It is the first program of our week together, and I am presuming, at least I don't have any reason to suspect that there would be any reason why we would not have our regular schedule this week, which would be 2 hours today, an hour and a half tomorrow, and 2 hours on Wednesday. I sure hope so. Thank you for your willingness to tune in and support the Head On Radio Network and support the Virtual Center. I appreciate it. I say this numerous times because, very honestly, I don't think I can say it enough. When I think about it, and over the weekend, I think about the program coming Monday, and I just feel so excited and honestly honored to be able to come to you on a regular basis and get into these kinds of issues. I'm a little bit nervous today. At the same time, I'm a little bit excited. And if I can play it right, that's a good. That sometimes is a good match, so to speak. But what makes me a little bit nervous, as I mentioned many times, is it's been 5 days since we've been together, and the more I think about when I have longer to think about the program, 3 or 4 days, it becomes a little bit more intimidating than it does when it just comes every single day. So when you're putting together a program with another one coming tomorrow and another one coming the next day, you really don't have time to think about the overall significance of the program and why it's important to do the best job you can and all of that stuff. But when you have 3 or 4 days between one program and the next one, you do think of those kinds of things, and I do. And I kind of feel that the material, I believe that the material itself is so important and so significant that it creates a little bit of pressure on me to make sure that I do it well, that I'm fair. I hate to say fair and balanced because somebody already uses that. But I do want to be balanced. I do want to be fair. But at the same time, I work as hard as I can to try to make sure that I am able to get across why I think this particular material is so significant. In today, the specific politics of this particular issue, the bailout and the threatened default and the last-minute agreement and the willingness of the German government and Angela Merkel and the others to agree to yet another bailout for Greece and all of that, I'd like to get into the whole issue of international finance a little bit. This is not my area. If you looked at my transcript, you would see that I've never had a course in economics, a formal course in economics beyond high school. And not only that, but I've actually never had a course necessarily, obviously, in international economics. I've had courses in international affairs. And economics is one of them, and so basically what I've tried to learn, I've pretty much tried to learn by myself. So I'm on rather thin ice today, and I kind of know that going in, and I want you to know it, because I'm a little bit nervous about it. But at the same time, as I fool around with this material and seek ways to put it together so it makes some sense to me, hoping that if it makes sense to me, I can present it in a way maybe where it'll make some sense to you, because on the scale of 1 to 10, in terms of ability to really understand the complexities and the ins and outs of finance, especially international finance, I'm down in the 1 to 2 range, or maybe even lower than that. So if I can make it make sense to me, then I'm hoping that it will make sense to you. But the fact of the matter is, it's extremely important. And it has become more and more important to me as I've gone over this material to realize that we really can't understand the whole Greek situation, the debt that other European nations are in, and all the rest of it, unless we do understand something about this idea of international creditors and the international market and the international financial market and all the rest of it. For example, this is just an example. One of the things that I've been into this morning, and I don't know, there are probably a number of you out there that have heard of this, but I had never heard of it, and this is an organization called the Basel Committee. And so I had to go to the internet and look it up, because I saw in the courses of the materials I was reading reference to the Basel Committee. I had no idea what the Basel Committee was. Well, the Basel Committee is a group of nations. I believe there are 15, at least 15, maybe 19 to 20 foreign nations whose finance ministers have gotten together and set up a formal organization in the 1970s to regulate and manage international finance. And they have, they have goals, and they have a mission statement, and they have specific standards that they employ, and they have a number of subcommittees that make recommendations in each of these particular areas. And I was totally unaware until about 3 or 4 hours ago that such an organization even existed. I'll tell you what led me to it. I saw a reference in one of the pieces I read to the fact that the Basel Committee in the early 1970s encouraged nations, governments, to avoid printing their own money. Now, one of the things, as for those that have listened to the Virtual Center for some time, you may know that the issue of printing money, paper money, was one of the major issues surrounding the fight over ratification of the Constitution, because 7 of the original 13 colonies had sought to pull their citizens out of financial distress after the American Revolution by printing paper money. And one of the major issues, and we'll see this later today, one of the major issues that really bothered Hamilton and Madison and the rest of the Federalists, the supporters of the Constitution, was the Constitution's promise to forbid the states from printing their own money. The assumption being that the finance, the nation's finances will be handled at the upper level, at the national central government level. That was really it. So when I saw a reference to the fact that the Basel Committee in the early 1970s had encouraged governments to not print their own money, but instead to seek needed currency, if they found that there was a shortage of currency in their particular nations, they should pursue solutions through the market.
Hey, Bill.
Yes, Bob.
You just made a little light go on when you were talking about the constitutional provisions regarding currency. Isn't that provision particularly interesting when taken into account alongside the fact that the most common units of currency were actually Spanish currency throughout a large part of the new United States at the time?
Except that as British colonies, they had pretty much been dependent on Britain for circulating currency, but Britain always shorted them, because Britain's idea was the way you keep colonial economies dependent on the mother country is to curtail the availability of circulating money.
Right, and I guess that's why it developed the way it did, because well up into the 19th century, Spanish doubloons and pieces of eight, the old reference for a quarter as 2 bits.
Yes.
That comes from the fact that it was 1/4, 1/4 of a piece of eight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, oddly enough, while the states were forbidden from printing their own currency, it would appear that a lot of, states were operating not under the American dollar or in the colonial period under the British pound, but operating under the Spanish currency that was frankly much more readily available as a result of the markets in Mexico,
right,
Central and South America.
And Bob, a lot, and this is the part of this financial mess that I don't, that I'm not quite comfortable with, because I'll be honest with you, I've never been in a situation where I had to know it, if that makes sense. If we're talking finance and investment and those kinds of things, I get a little bit a little bit muddy sometimes. But what was happening is that a lot of people were so indebted to British merchants, especially southern planters, were so indebted to British merchants because of the lack of circulating currency. And so what the merchants would do would be issue their own form of paper money, which was, of course, private. But it would be payable. You could pay off debts with it, and a number of the colonies got to the point where they would accept it for taxes, and then they would retire it. In other words, they would take it out of circulation as it came in payment for taxes and things.
And we actually saw that go on well into the federal period and up into the 20th century, when you consider the number of Americans working in Appalachian coal mines who were never paid a single penny in actual recoverable American money.
It was all scrip.
Right. So the Constitution forbids the several states from printing their own money, but
right,
it did not forbid companies and corporations,
exactly,
from printing their
own. That's a major point, because when the Basel Committee recommended that governments seek to infuse currency into their economy through the market, what they're talking about is borrowing from private banks. And the banks then would issue their own form of currency. In a sense, they were creating money. They were printing money. So at the same time the states were forbidden to do it under the Constitution, private lenders were allowed to do it. And so in a sense, the entire economy was floating on debt. And that's really what a lot of this Greek situation I'm becoming more and more aware of is about. I think we mentioned in our conversation prior to when we were on the air about Goldman Sachs. And what Goldman Sachs did in the early 21st century, I believe in the year 2002, 2001, came to the aid of Greece because they were living above their means, and the European creditors were monitoring their expenses and making sure that they didn't, you know, that debt wasn't runaway debt. And the Greek government got in trouble, and Goldman Sachs came to bail them out. And what they did was they made a very magical loan, if you will, which allowed them to convert some of the debt international debt into domestic debt, which in effect gave them the opportunity to hide it. And so in a sense, what it did was put Greece into even greater debt, primarily to Goldman Sachs. And when the Greek government began to fail and threaten to default, they would naturally go to Goldman Sachs because they owed so much. I think it was $5.8 billion. And Goldman Sachs basically started to talk about the sanctity of contracts, and we have a contract to creditors, and the creditors have to be paid. So what they were saying is there's no grace period allowed. We can't do anything. So in a sense, what they ended up doing, Paul Krugman refers to it as a roach hotel. Once you get in, you can't get out, you know?
Well, exactly.
And that's kind of what happened. And it's very complex. It seems to me it's always been very difficult to me because I have trouble getting my arms around it. You know, I just don't quite understand.
I think you're doing fine, and you're probably out ahead of the vast majority of us, myself included. As you approach this,
I'm struggling to understand it, and I appreciate what you said because you're exactly right. There's absolutely no question that one way that the mother country chose to keep the colonies in line was to control their currency and to limit their credit.
To a certain extent, isn't that? I mean, I hesitate in trying to come up with the terms by which I describe what's going on in Greece. But to a certain extent, isn't that exactly it? Hasn't? Oh golly! hasn't Germany conquered Europe?
Yes, in terms of credit.
And in terms of access to currency? Yeah.
Bob, that is really, it seems to me, when you cut through all of this stuff and get down to the bottom line, that is really the essence of the significance of this thing. Because what you have is that these international creditors have so, you know, we're seeing a bunch of nations. Greece isn't the only one. Spain and Portugal and Italy and the Netherlands and Holland and Finland are in debt, and they're in debt to international creditors to the point that it, you know, and the way they are getting in is the same kind of stuff that was pulled off in this country in 07 and 08 when we went into the recession and the real estate bubble burst. Most people who entered into contracts and buying homes that they couldn't afford really didn't understand the terms of the contract because they manipulated the numbers in such a way it looked like they could pay it. And the fact of the matter is they couldn't. And that's what these countries have allowed themselves to get into. So you're right. In a sense, Germany and to a lesser degree France, at least the creditor interest in it, and you know, are in a sense calling the shots for many of these countries because they've become, you know, they've become established power over them because they control their finance, they control their currency. They literally control what can or can't happen to their economy. And it's scary. The potential of this is really scary because there's no way to control them. Because in Europe, at least, while they have a common currency, the European Union doesn't control the currency. And that's where I want to go today, Bob, is back to the Confederation period, because that was really the issue here. As long as each state under the Confederation in the 1780s in the United States, as long as each state controlled its own currency, then it could basically do things like inflate the currency by printing paper money or passing legislation to postpone debts or postpone tax payments or something. In other words, you could basically make decisions on the state level in order to meet the need of your citizens. If your citizens were having financial difficulties, then you could, at the state level, you could pass legislation or do something to alleviate those tough times for your own citizens. Once the Constitution was ratified, with that no paper money permitted on the parts of the states, then management of the economy shifted to the national level.
And isn't it fascinating? And I'll leave after this, but isn't it fascinating that the first thing the Confederacy does is the individual? I'm not talking about the Confederacy as a whole, but the individual states, such as the Bank of, and via organisms like the Bank of Richmond, begin printing paper money.
Money, right, right.
And it was for all intents and purposes fiat money from the get-go, wasn't it?
Yes.
Because there's no way they could have amassed the gold to back it up.
No, there's nothing to back it up. It's all based on faith. I mean, if you're going to accept it, you've got to believe that it's worth what it says what's printed on it.
Exactly. Well, I'll step back now.
Okay, Bob, but you're right on, and I think you got me into this a little bit, so I appreciate that very much. But I neglected at the outset of our program, and I do want to go back because we've gone 20 minutes into the program already. I want to go back and share with you our phone numbers and ways that you can communicate with us and you can get into this conversation and hopefully straighten myself and Bob and the rest of us out. If you're out there and you understand some of this stuff, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is area code 304-663-4676. That's 304-663-4676. If you'd like to communicate directly with me via email, I would love to hear from you. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. And parenthetically, I might say that one of our listeners, one of our regular listeners, has been communicating with me over the last 3 or 4 days on this Greek situation. And the question that the listener raised, which I thought was a fabulous one, and I hadn't even thought about it, was the fact that the British crown, the British sterling, Britain didn't adopt the euro. So the question is, how can these demands be put on a nation like Greece, which adopted the euro, and then you have a nation like Great Britain that didn't? And I went, of course the reality is that all the members of the European Union have not adopted the euro. And one of them is Great Britain. And one of the decisions that the new government, the newly elected conservative government that was just elected last month in Great Britain, is going to have to deal with is the issue of staying within the European Union itself, because there's a significant movement among conservatives to pull out of the European Union and become make the Great Britain, I was going to say the mother country, independent again. And that's a major political issue in the United Kingdom. So that's what I could come up with, is the fact that there was no requirement that members adopt the euro. But the thinking was that the more nations bought into the euro, in other words, the more nations there were who bought into the euro as their currency, the more likely it would create European unity and eventually lead nations to move towards more political unity. And that seems to have been the thinking on the part of a lot of the leaders who were orchestrating the move toward the European Union. I would suggest to you that that also explains a lot about those who are opposed to the European Union. And I'm specifically thinking in this country about the right in America that is opposed to it. And we touched on an article last week by George Will, and I wanted to revisit that because he takes a strong stand against the European Union. His argument is that the euro is not the problem. The European Union is the problem. And I wanted to deal with that a little bit because I think it's politically very significant. Before we do that, though, I also wanted to remind you that we now have a Facebook page, which is obviously entitled the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, and I've been trying to post a number of things on it, and I'll be very honest with you, much of what I have posted and much of what I intend to post are issues that we've dealt with here over the months at the Virtual Center in our programs. It seems to me that we've touched on a number of significant issues here which really need to go down on paper. And so over the months, I tried to do it occasionally by writing a piece that I would send into a newspaper and hope that they would publish. And unfortunately, I've had, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 over the last year, a year and a half, published. And I want to get them on our website. I don't want to put them on there all at once, obviously, because people wouldn't read them. But what I'm trying to do is every 3 or 4 days, I'm posting another one. And of course, you know, I also continue to write these myself. There's absolutely no question that when we move on to a new topic, I'm going to sit down and try to pull all of this stuff together, because I really believe that we've got to nail this stuff down. We've got to put it in writing to the point that it'll be there for not only for us, but for those who come after us, especially those who come after me. So that's my plan. So again, I invite you to visit our Facebook page. I ask you to like it. A number of you have, and I appreciate that so much, because that's what the Facebook folks ask you to do, is like it. And a number of you have asked to get on a friends list where we can share ideas and share emails and notes and that kind of thing. And I've befriended an awful lot of people in the last couple of weeks. As I said, you know, I've thought a lot about this, because it seems to, on the surface at least, it seems to promote the kind of communication, regular communication amongst folks, which I think is a very good thing. It's using technology in order to keep communication alive, and I really do support that. And I really think that in our technological age, we are going to have to continue to stick together and to continue to talk and communicate with each other in order to keep communication alive in this technological age. So in that sense, I support it very much. On the other hand, it's kind of like the Internet itself. Once you open up your website or your Facebook page, you really don't have any control over what comes your way. You have control over what you send to others, and I think all of us know we need to be a little bit careful about that. But don't necessarily, we kind of surrender the opportunity to control what comes our way. We don't have to read it, but on the other hand, to make the decision to not read it, you've got to at least look at it. One of the things I've noticed in the 2 weeks that I've been on Facebook, it's just about 2 weeks, maybe a little bit less, the number of people out there that are making it a mission, their personal mission, to save my soul. And I kind of not really interested. I don't think if my soul's going to be saved, it's not going to happen through Facebook. So, that's kind of the way I feel. But anyway, that's just an aside and an offhanded comment. Before we get into this, we're into it in some pretty good depth now, thanks to Bob's call and Bob Kincaid's comments and that kind of thing. But I wanted to share with you, one of the things I got off Facebook, interesting enough, I've reconnected through Facebook with an old friend. And when I say old friend, I mean like 45, 50 years old. And I haven't seen him for 15 years, 20 years at the most. And, in fact, I made a comment on Facebook. He put a photo of himself on there with a glass of wine in his hand. And I told him that even though I hadn't seen him for 20 years, it kind of seemed to me that the last time I did see him, he was doing the same thing. And he immediately came back and pointed out, no, if you remember at that time, it wasn't wine we were drinking, Bill. It was cheap scotch. And that's probably true. But anyway, this friend put posted an article on his Facebook page that I got that I have absolutely been all over all weekend. And I wanted to share it with you because I think it is delicious in a lot of important ways. Let me get my hands on it now. It's an article that originally appeared in The Onion, which is a publication that I know a number of you have heard about. And it deals with the issue of safe space at colleges and universities, and I've read a little bit about this on the Chronicle of Higher Education page about institutions who are moving toward the idea of creating safe spaces for people who are encountering things in college that they really can't handle, that's overwhelming them, and they don't have a place to go, and they're too shy to go to a counselor. And, is there a place where they can kind of just go and relax and be alone and get themselves together and escape kind of the negatives? Well, this particular – and I've thought about that, and I thought the whole purpose of an education, a good education, is to force people, students, to deal with ideals and issues that they aren't comfortable with. I mean, I've always operated on the assumption, and a lot of my colleagues are the same, that the only way you can expect people to think about things is if they are confronted with things that they've never thought about before, things that may contradict or conflict with issues, things they do believe. As a student, I can remember very well that the best classes I had, and I think most people would agree with this, the best classes I had are the classes where the instructor was constantly forcing me to confront things that I wasn't comfortable with, that I didn't like. it never occurred to me to run to a safe space in order to get away with this, from these ideas. The whole idea of college is to confront them and deal with them, not run away from them. I've always believed that. So lo and behold, I get this copy of this article on my Facebook page the other day from The Onion. And it comes, ironically enough, since this is my home state, it comes from the state of Massachusetts, from a town in Massachusetts called Lynnfield. And it relates to a Lynnfield College student who graduated in 2009 from Lynnfield College. More specifically, it relates to the fact that this student's parents, her name, the student's name is Stigmore, S-T-I-G-M-O-R-E, and her parents, at a dedication ceremony, made a contribution to Lynnwood College, Lynnfield College, in order to create a safe space. Because there was a particular class one time that made their daughter extremely uncomfortable.
Hey, Bill.
Yes, Bob.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, but I just want to make sure that we're clear on something.
Okay.
Nothing in The Onion is real.
Okay.
It's satire.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
But it's real in the sense that a lot of people believe.
Oh, absolutely.
That's
the brilliance of The Onion is that.
Right.
There's another piece out there that I cite quite frequently, man passionate defender of Constitution that exists only in his own head.
Yes, yes.
And that's, you know, that's a Constitution that has the Pledge of Allegiance in it and references to Jesus and all.
Right.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to jump in and make sure.
No, I've seen a lot of references in the Chronicle to institutions that are tending to move in the direction of creating safe spaces.
Absolutely.
In order to keep students from confronting ideas that they don't like.
And at the risk of hijacking this conversation, I will say that that is an outgrowth of, either it's an outgrowth of or it's a parallel with what you see in a lot of social good organizations, a lot of 501c3 types.
Right.
You know, I've sat in meetings where people disagree, and someone will say, well, you know, I just really don't feel safe right now.
Right, right.
And you're sitting in a group of 30 people, all of whom are a bunch of kumbaya singers, and half of whom smell like patchouli, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's no way that fists are going to fly, but if you disagree
right.
with them, I just don't feel safe right now.
I got you. I got
so,
you.
So, I'm sorry. Well, I'll go away now.
No, you're right. You're exactly right. We are afraid
of earnest and honest discourse.
The point that I wanted to make is how dangerous this thinking is, because it's becoming real. And the point is, we've made reference here months and months ago to a piece of legislation that ran through the United States Senate in 1816, where the federal government was raised the taxes, the duty on foreign books. Because the argument was that the government believed, this was in 1816, Thomas Jefferson was still alive. He had ceased to be president 8 years earlier. And he took a strong stand against this because basically the argument is we need to protect our young people from dangerous foreign ideas. And the way the government chose to do it is to raise the tax on foreign books to the point that people would not buy them because they were so expensive. And in justifying that particular piece of legislation, the spokesman for the Senate Finance Committee at that time made this passionate defense of the government's role in shielding our citizens from dangerous ideas. And, of course, we know that an awful lot of the opposition to the Common Core standards, and I know we experienced that here in West Virginia during the last legislative session, a lot of the opposition to the Common Core is based pretty much on the same kind of things, that what people want is the ability to be able to control curriculum in order to guarantee as much as it's possible to guarantee what students will end up being exposed to, what they will end up leaving, what they will be leaving the school believing. And so in a sense, what we end up with is an educational system which is aimed more at controlling what people think, than in fact teaching them how to think. And in teaching, and not teaching them how to solve problems, because the way you solve problems is to seek more and more information and to do research. The fact of the matter is we want our curriculum to provide the information which leads our people to the appropriate results. And that is putting us at a distinct disadvantage in our effort to turn out students who are competitive with the rest of the world, especially as the research and skill demands in the current age become higher and higher and more extreme. Our people can't handle it. In effect, they need safe spaces. So in a sense, this is a very, very real issue, and I think it presents a problem. But some of the language here, for example, according to this piece, when our Alexis felt weird after hearing someone discuss an idea that did not conform to her personally held beliefs, she had no place to turn, said Arnold Stigmore, standing outside a $2 million space that reportedly features soothing music, neutral colored walls, oversized floor cushions, fun board games, and a variety of snacks. God forbid any of you in your years at this institution are ever confronted with an opinion you do not share. But if you are, you will have a refuge on this campus. Unquote. And that's the kind of presentation I was talking about. And the point is, it is so real. And the reason people read it, and the reason I thought it was delicious, is because it is defining, it is putting the finger on so much of what's happening in our education system at the very time that we should be turning out young people who can confront problems and solve problems, etc. But this idea of shielding people from negative ideas or strange ideas, I think is something very, very, very frightening. And I thought that this particular piece in The Onion made that point so well. And I want to thank my friend for sending it to me. I knew he'd know I like that, because that's the kind of stuff I've always been afraid of. In fact, in our conversation back and forth, I made the point to him, and I said, in 50 years of teaching, I can't remember a class in which I didn't at least try to make somebody uncomfortable about something. Because it's only when you confront new ideas, new concepts, new perspectives, that you are forced to see the contradiction between what's out there and what you already believe. And it's only by trying to work out those contradictions that we learn. And that's really the point of this particular piece. And I want now this particular topic that we're on here with the Greek bailout and stuff, a lot of this stuff is really, I think, head scratching stuff. And I think it's the kind of information that is so complex and so beyond many of us. I'm not going to say most of us, because I don't know that we tend not to read it, and we tend to go to the people whose opinion we trust, and we trust them to tell us what we ought to believe. It seems to me that when you look at some of the issues here and you confront them and you weigh apparent contradictions and you try to figure out what these contradictions are all about, that you can begin to understand. And I want to go back to the conversation that Bob and I had at the outset of today's program, about a half an hour ago, I guess. And basically, the point that I wanted to make is that when I saw a reference to the Basel Committee recommending to the finance ministers of those who sat on the Basel Committee, and on the Internet, if you look on the Internet, you'll see a whole list of the countries, Argentina and Venezuela, the United States, Great Britain, China, South Korea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That nations do their best to avoid expanding their own currency, printing their own currency, and instead that they look for ways to supplement their own currency through the market. Find market means. Now, what that means is borrow. And what you do is, since you are the government and you do have the authority to issue more money as the government of a particular nation, then if you are being encouraged to borrow it, then what you are encouraged to, what you are being encouraged to do is go into debt. And of course, what this does is it fuels the international economy, because it fuels international finance, because there are a lot of people that are more than willing to lend, not only individuals who are good for it, but nations who are good for it, the money that they will need. And the reality is that several nations are in serious debt as a result of this. And so what we are seeing is a gradual split between creditor nations and debtor nations within the same kind of operation. And I think that the potential for that is extremely dangerous. And I think that's the message that this situation with the potential to threaten Greek default on its debt really raises. I think it forces us to get into areas of international finance that most of us really don't understand that well, and when I say most of us, I'm speaking for myself, and I'm assuming that I'm probably in the majority here, but I don't know that. But anyway, I think it is extremely significant and extremely important. And so what I wanted to do is today for in our program is I wanted to go back, and I wanted to touch on a few things that perhaps we talked about before from this different perspective. And more specifically, I wanted to go back to an article that we looked at last Wednesday. It was an article written by Ellen Brown. I'm looking to see if I had noted where this particular article was published. And I didn't jot that down, unfortunately. I'm sorry. But the title, it's about the Pope, and it's about the Pope's recommendations, or the Pope's encyclical, which we spent quite a bit of time on, as you know. But more specifically, it's about what the Pope said about the international banking system. And Ellen Brown uses the Pope's encyclical in order to bring to us the story of the emergence in the medieval period, in the Middle Ages, of Franciscan attempts to make currency available, make credit available to people in need by opening up non-profit banks, places where people could go, pawn shops. It's the same thing as a pawn shop, where you bring in your toaster or your television or your computer or whatever, and you pawn it in order to get money. And so the assumption, you know, the idea was that what the Franciscans did in the medieval period is address the plight of common people by opening up a series of these pawn shops, which made credit available to people who would never get credit any other way. That's what Ellen Brown believes Pope Francis was talking about when he talked about the need to reform the international system of finance. and how we let the recession of 2007-08 go by without making the kinds of substantial, significant reforms that the situation seems to call for. The Pope's encyclical implied that we missed a tremendous opportunity, because the only time that you can make major reform like this is during a crisis. We were in a crisis, yet we refused to make the reforms that Pope Francis believes were called for. So let me go back and read the relevant paragraph from the Pope's encyclical as recreated here by Ellen Brown. And then I wanted to go into a couple of comments about it, if I can. The Pope said the following: "Today, in view of the common good, there's urgent need for politics and economics to enter into a frank dialogue in the service of life, especially human life. Saving banks at any cost, making the public pay the price, foregoing a firm commitment to reviewing and reforming the entire system, only reaffirms the absolute power of a financial system, a power which has no future and will only give rise to new crises after a slow, costly, and only apparent recovery." Again, what the Pope is saying, that we missed this tremendous chance. And what we ended up with looks like it's working. But the fact of the matter is, the real substantive changes that the Pope believes were called for were not made. And so therefore, we're just, you know, if I could put words in the Pope's mouth, which I would never choose to do, I guess what the Pope is implying here is, I guess what we're all doing is just waiting for the next shoe to drop, so to speak. The financial crisis of 2007-08 provided an opportunity to develop a new economy, more attentive to ethical principles, and new ways of regulating speculative financial practices and virtual wealth. But the response to the crisis did not include rethinking the outdated criteria which continue to rule the world. And Ellen Brown, in her piece, makes a lot of the Pope's comment, rethinking the outdated criteria which continue to rule the world. In her mind, the Pope saying that way is a call, she believes, is the Pope's call for revolution. It's a call for a significantly new way to finance international affairs. Ways which take the common people, the people who are suffering the most, into consideration, and finding ways to deal with them. And then it's from that lead-in that Ellen Brown goes back into the medieval Franciscan monks in their efforts to open non-interest-bearing banks. And she points out, of course, and we touched on this last week, and I don't think it's necessary to go through the whole article again, but she points out that in the medieval period, the church preached against the practice of usury, which was the practice of exorbitant interest, of charging money for the use of money, as being inhuman, as being immoral, as being unchristian. Lending money at interest in the medieval period was forbidden to Christians as a breach, and I'm quoting from the article here, as a breach of the prohibition on usury proclaimed by Jesus in Luke 6:33. The problem was that by eliminating credit, by attacking usury, the result was a serious shortage of currency. And therefore, throughout Europe, there was a need to expand the monetary supply through loans on credit. In other words, if you borrow money, then that money that you borrow and spend becomes part of the money supply. And if we have enough of this going on, the needs for currency flow are satisfied. I want to read the next paragraph because something occurred to me on rereading this that I neglected to mention the other day, and I think it's significant. An exception to Christians forbidding of usury. An exception was therefore made to the prescription against usury for the Jews. In other words, Christianity made an exception and said the Jews can loan money. Jewish scripture forbade usury to brothers, meaning other Jews. So the fact of the matter is the Jews were allowed to loan money on credit, but they, in their own scriptures, they were not allowed to loan credit to other Jews. The only ones that they lent them to were Christians. This gave the Jews a virtual monopoly on lending. It allowed them to charge excessively high rates. Interest was sometimes as high as 60%, Ellen Brown points out. There's no question that this is the whole anti-Semitic idea of the Jewish lenders, Shakespeare, for example, and our whole stereotype attitude towards Jews is to be found, it seems to me, the origins are to be found in this particular practice. Alan Brown points out that these high rates were particularly devastating to the poor. And in order to remedy that situation, the Franciscans formed these pawn shops called Montes Pietatis. These shops lent at low or no interest on the securities or valuables left with the institution. Problems is the banks went broke because they weren't receiving any income. And so then the Franciscans adopted low interest banks, and they began this in Italy. The result was by 1515, this practice of the Franciscans became generally accepted, and in fact was declared to be meritorious, that the people finally had a way to get their hands on money that would circulate. Ellen Brown points out that this practice still goes on in many European countries, in Italy and many other countries. And eventually it evolved into the idea of public banks, cost savings. She points out that they do exist in Germany. They are called Sparkassen, which are municipal banks. And she points out in the United States today, the state-owned Bank of North Dakota is an example of these public banks. So the idea is that the purpose of these banks is not so much to make money, but to serve people. There would be a lot of opposition to these banks by private banks. I'm struck by the fact, and I don't think I mentioned this last week, so let me mention it here, to provide broadband service to rural areas where financially private broadband companies won't go because there aren't enough people there to make the investment, the responsibility of providing broadband access. And the major companies, the Comcasts and the Suddenlinks and those companies are fighting that like crazy because that would put them into competition with public broadband utilities. Ellen Brown points out that that's usually the name that's associated with it. And I'm quoting her directly here. Turning public commodities and services into asset classes from which wealth can be siphoned by rich private investors. In other words, encouraging private to creditors, selling off the commons in order to generate currency. Obviously, she points out that this would begin with things like timber, natural gas, those kinds of things. These things have long been privatized. But she points out that the trend in education and housing, whatever municipalities own that has value, is for credit. Therefore, states and municipalities have borrowed money based on the value of their public assets and gone into serious debt. One of the things is the privatization of food, where international food corporations or organizations are trading food commodities, and these things are disconnected from the market. So consequently, we've had starvation, we've had price, and the rest of it, because once the process of financialization becomes separated from the people who need that service, then those people's interests do not make it in the relation to human need, to people. And of course, we see this moving in other areas into issues related to water, for example. Let me read this paragraph, because this is one I want to focus on a little bit. We have bought into this financialization scheme based on what Alan Brown calls a faulty economic model, in which we have allowed money to be created privately by banks and lent to governments, as the Bank of England recently acknowledged. The Bank of England has recently acknowledged that nations in a top finances, nations and municipalities have been forced to sell off their assets in order to generate regulating currency and economic viability. This becomes the basis for development. Well, this is to find the. And what Ellen Brown points out is this is where we're running into problems in the West, because we take control of the banks. Governments begin to open up these private municipal banks in order to create funding. And she points out that China and other Asian nations are moving ahead with this kind of development. Where did they find the money? They basically issue it. What private banks do in Western countries, publicly owned and controlled banks do in many Asian countries. Governments have taken control of the engines of credit, the banks, and are operating them for the benefit of people and for their own economies. We have a commitment to private banks. What we will see in our second hour, we've reached the top of our first hour, and I want to take a five-minute break here. What we will see in our second hour is the results of this, not only in the Greek situation, but in our own situation here within the United States, as we look at where some of the problems are coming for states and municipalities who find themselves in debt that they can't get out of in order to. And so one has to ask, and this is the question I've been asking myself all the way through this as I've been reading over this material. Where's all the private capital? Where's all the profit? Where's all the re-expand? This is the triple down. This is what austerity is supposed to do. That what you do is you force governments to play it close to the vest, to control their spending, At the same time, you give tax breaks and all kinds of lucrative opportunities to the private sector and drive economic expansion. And the result will be that the benefits of that expansion will trickle down through the economy. It'll create more jobs, better jobs, and nations will expand it. And in place of that, governments have had to try to find a way to sustain economic activity at all by generating currency. And the only way they can do it is to sell off public assets to these same private banks in order to generate development money. The problem is that these governments and municipalities have those debts back. And I would suggest to you that that puts the creditors in tremendous positions of power. And the fact of the matter is, the number one recipient of any form has been through a couple of other bailouts earlier in the 21st century. The increase to Greece, it's not going into the economy. It's not stimulating the economy. It's not creating jobs. Unemployment in Greece remains at 25%. The benefit to the credit are leaving the country and are going into the same to get all the attention here. That's what we're talking about here, is the link between financialization, international finance, credit and debt, and power, world power. Those are the issues that I'd like to come back with after our five-minute break in our second hour. It's 5 minutes after the hour of 2 in the East, 5 minutes 5 minutes after the hour, 5 minutes after 2 in the East. I kind of messed that up a little bit. You're listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. We're going to pause for a five-minute break, and then we'll be right back with our second hour. Please stay with us. Thank you.
Honorable Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Here's Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid. Welcome to our second hour here at the Virtual Center on this Monday, the 20th day of July in the year 2015. If you are just joining us, welcome to today's program. If you've been with us through the first hour, then I want to thank you for staying with us. We kind of slogged through what I think are some pretty complex issues in our first hour. I think in the second one, it'll become a little bit easier to get our arms around, so to speak. Because I think we're going to be looking at a few of the outcomes of some of the more abstract, speculative things we were talking about in hour one. We were talking about the issues of credit and debt and the extent to which power is directly associated with these. I welcome you. I want to thank those of you who have been with us through the program for staying with us. I do want to let you know how much we appreciate that as well. I also want to make mention of the fact that I know, as you know, if you're a regular listener of the Head On Radio Network and you listen to Bob Kincaid's program in the evening, as I know many do, this is totally listener-supported broadcasting. And what I mean is there's no advertising, there are no advertisers kicking money in here. Nobody involved in this whole thing is making a salary. Basically, it's all something that we believe needs to be done, and we're trying to find a way to do it. And I want you to know that we appreciate so much your support, and whatever you might be able to do to help Bob out and help the folks at the Head On Radio Network out as they struggle to pay the bills and keep the lights on, so to speak, then I really, really encourage you to do that. I hope that our programming, in your mind at least, reaches a level of quality where you begin to appreciate and to realize how important it is that we keep discussions like this on the air. So whatever you might do, I know you can go to the Head On Radio homepage, and there's a PayPal button there, or you can mail it in. There's an address there. Whatever you can do, and I mean that, it can be as small as you feel comfortable. The point is that if enough people do it, we continue to be on the air. So thank you. Welcome back, and again, I invite you to participate actively in our program by giving us a call on a line that's been reserved just for you. Our phone number is area code 304-663-4676. 304-663-4676. 4676, of course, is Horn, H-O-R-N. My email address, if you'd like to communicate directly with me via email, one-on-one, my email address, waobrien906@gmail.com. waobrien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. And I remind you as well that we now have a Facebook page for the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. I invite you to check in. I ask you to like it. I invite you to communicate and comment, and we can probably engage in dialogue on our Facebook page. I'm getting myself into the habit each day where I check the Facebook page each day, and I'm spending more and more time there because I'm finding that many of the people who are interested in this program spend their time there. And heaven knows we want to go where the people and where their interests are. So I invite you to communicate your thoughts with us that way as well. We've been dealing with the issues of credit and finance as they affect the situation, the Greek situation, which has kind of engulfed the world over the last couple of weeks. And let me begin our program this hour by suggesting that a return to the 18th century debate over the Constitution of the United States, I think, is going to do a lot to clarify this particular situation. However, it works both ways. Because I think that what we're going to find after we complete coverage of this topic is that our understanding of early American history will be advanced and will benefit as well from this kind of analogy or this kind of a comparison. So I hope that you will bear with me. In this morning's New York Times, Nobel Prize-winning economist, liberal economist, Paul Krugman, who has been writing over the last couple of weeks on the Greek situation, had a column in this morning's New York Times on the op-ed page, in which he raises the question of debt, not just in Greece, but throughout Europe as well. He mentions that Greece is experiencing a financial situation that is actually worse than the Great Depression. Unemployment is in excess of 25%. But he also points out that Spain, while its economy has begun to grow, it looked like it was going to be the default nation, if you remember, 3 or 4 months ago. Now its economy seems to be back on its feet, and it also is growing. But Spain is still confronted with an unemployment rate of 22%. Finland is experiencing a depression very similar to what's happening in southern Europe. Denmark and the Netherlands are doing badly as well. What Paul Krugman devotes his attention to in this morning's piece is the common currency known as the euro. His point being that when nations, independent nations, buy into a common currency like the euro, they lose their flexibility. They lose their opportunity to legislate their way out of financial difficulties that they currently find themselves in. In other words, once all these nations come together and agree on a common currency, then by definition, nations lose their individuality. They lose their individual ability to meet and address financial situations that might emerge. He points out that when the discussions about the common currency, the euro, first broke out in the 21st century, you know, in the 90s, in fact, some people, economists, were very critical of the idea because they suggested that with the creating of the common currency, nations lose their independence, their ability to act independently. And they were criticized. And, of course, Krugman considers himself amongst that group. They were criticized by European economists. And, in fact, he points out, this might be a good article for all of us to look at. He says, in January of 2010, two European economists wrote an article entitled, "It Can't Happen. It's a Bad Idea. It Won't Last." And what they were doing was mocking American economists like Paul Krugman, who warned that the euro would not solve problems, it would cause problems. As he points out, that particular article has become a classic, because now what the doubters predicted early in the 21st century has come into being. And now suddenly these European skeptics are kind of heroes, because it turns out that they were able to predict indeed what would happen. And Krugman makes the point that the idea of the euro sounded so good. It sounded great. It seemed forward-looking. It linked Europeans closer and closer together. It was the kind of thing that appealed to more and more people. And many people believed that eventually it would lead to political union, that nations with a common currency are going to adopt more and more commonality in their desire to manage that currency. In other words, political union would flow directly out of the adoption of the common currency in the euro. Those arguments were extremely strong, and they made it possible for Europe to pretty much ignore the predictions of the critics. And as he said, in Europe, it became quickly very difficult to raise objections to the currency project. He said, I remember the atmosphere in the 90s, in the early 90s. Anyone who questioned the desirability of the euro was effectively shut out of the discussion. If you were an American expressing doubts, you were accused of having ulterior motives, namely that you were trying to prop up the dollar. And this is the point where Krugman uses the term Roach Motel, because of the debt involved in this kind of situation. Like a Roach Motel, it's a trap that's hard to escape, Krugman says. If Greece still had its own currency, the case for devaluing that currency, improving Greek competitiveness, and ending the deflation that Greece is experiencing would be pretty clear. So now the question is, what do you do? As I've mentioned, one of the advantages of reading newspapers like the Times, the Washington Post and the New York Times and the LA Times and all the rest of it, is to look at the comments of people out there who tune in. One of the comments to Krugman's column this morning particularly struck me, because it brings us back into the 18th century to the founders. And that's where I'd like to take us in this, our second hour. Basically, what this commenter points out is that given the problems, given the situation that Europe finds itself in now with so many of these nations in debt, maybe the next step is political unity. Maybe there's no direction, there's no place to go other than forward. The commenter says the following: there may be no choice but to press forward to a real union as the U.S. did with the Constitution replacing the unworkable Articles of Confederation. This will imply a union-wide taxing authority, as in the United States, so that taxes are collected fairly across all the states, and probably an EU-wide retirement system like Social Security, so that no country can complain about lazy people in this country or that country who are retiring at 50. In other words, once you buy into the common currency, once you buy into union economically, what you find is that more and more unity seems to be the only way to make this work. Political unity, cultural unity. Instead of nitpicking at each other and saying, why is it we continue to work throughout most of our working lives, those people retire at 50 years older or even younger. Once you get a national management of currency, then many of those arguments disappear. And basically, the commenter also makes the point that this would likely mean that there'll be ongoing transfers of money from the richer countries to the poorer ones. That's what happens within the United States. He points out that the state of New York has been subsidizing Mississippi for decades. I live in West Virginia. I know that that's true here as well. Many of us who are sport fans know the structure of the National Football League. And the wealthier teams pay a subsidy to support the poorer teams. The wealthier nations pay to support those nations, will pay to support those nations that don't have the wherewithal to dig themselves out of the financial difficulties that they are in. We know, for example, I can remember writing an op-ed piece on this some time ago. We know, for example, that one of the difficulties in this country with health care is the difficulty in knowing exactly what health care costs. Because the costs, the costs of health care are inflated by the fact that those with insurance subsidize services to those who did not have it. And that, as much as anything else, it seems to me, warrants the creation of universal health care. I think Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is a step in that direction, but it's clearly not enough. But what we've had in our society is the fact that those who can pay for health care are subsidizing those who cannot. That's been true for some time. It's also true with the utilities. I can remember listening to the CEO of Appalachian Power here in West Virginia last year. And his point, he said, one of the things you need to understand in West Virginia is that there are so many people that can't pay their electric bill. Consequently, the rates we charge those who can pay need to be enough to generate service to those who can't pay. I would suggest to you that this is socialism, except that government's not controlling it. It's very significant. So that's what this commenter to Paul Krugman's piece in this morning's New York Times talked about, that this seems to be the direction that Europe will have to go in. And he makes mention of the Articles of Confederation. And of course, it goes without saying that rang a bell with me, specifically, I'm digging through my papers here, specifically going back to James Madison's Vices of the Political System of the United States. We covered this in some depth some time ago, but I think its relevance continues to be evident. In April of 1787, the Constitutional Convention is scheduled to meet on the 14th of May. In April 1787, Madison releases a document called The Vices of the Political System of the United States. He sends it to selected friends and colleagues. He basically is pointing out in this document what the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation are and why we need a change and why this convention that's upcoming next month is so important. And in his Vices of the Political System of the United States, Madison lists 12 vices. 12 things that are impossible with the Articles of Confederation that the Constitution will enable us to repair, to fix. Basically, what he's talking about is a government of the whole, the creation of a union, as opposed to the League of Friendship of Free and Independent States that exists under the Articles of Confederation. Of the 12 vices that Madison lists, 3 or 4 of them are particularly relevant to the international financial situation we've been looking at. Let me share with you a couple of these specifically. Number 4, the fourth vice that Madison addresses, he entitles Trespasses of the States on the Rights of Each Other, the inability of the states to work cooperatively, rather the tendency of free and independent states to compete with each other and try to get advantage over the others, and how this works to the detriment of everybody. That's, of course, Madison's point. He says, these are alarming symptoms and may be daily apprehended as we are admonished by daily experience. See the law of Virginia restricting foreign vessels to certain ports, or Maryland in favor of vessels belonging to her own citizens, of New York in favor of the same. In other words, states were passing legislation, making it impossible for other states to do business there, which is absolutely contradictory to what a nation needs to be about. That's the same situation that we have in Europe with these independent countries, obviously looking out for themselves, their own government looking out for themselves and their own citizens and their own investors and all the rest of it at the expense of others. And then Madison goes into specifics from the 18th century. Paper money, installments of debts, occlusion of courts, making property a legal tender, may likewise be deemed aggressions on the rights of other states. When my state prints paper money, that works to your detriment if you try to do business here. Or if our legislature suspends debt payments or creates legislation allowing debts to be paid in installments. In other words, I owe you money. You're in another state. I owe you money. But now my legislature has told me that I can pay you off in installments. That's obviously not treating you fairly. That obviously is trampling on your rights, your creditor rights. Occlusion of the courts. What we find in a number of states is that citizens were closing down the courts in order to prevent foreclosures on mortgages. Obviously, if you are a debtor of the state, if you loan money to the state and you're looking to get your payment, then by closing down the courts, we're making it impossible for you to receive to get reimbursement on your credit. Madison goes on, as the citizens of every state aggregately taken stand more or less in the relation of creditors or debtors to the citizens of every other state, acts of the debtor state in favor of debtors affect the creditor state in the same manner as they do its own citizens who are relatively creditors toward other citizens. Madison is describing exactly the situation in Europe that has been driving the Greek debt crisis. Citizens of one state in relation to another state are more or less in the relation of creditors or debtors. Some states, some nations are creditors, Germany, France. But it's clear that others are debtors, Greece, Finland, Netherlands, Denmark, Spain, Portugal. And what Madison is saying in this relationship of states as creditors or debtors, acts of a debtor state, whenever a debtor state or a nation takes action in favor of its debtors, it hurts the creditor state in the same manner as it would its own citizens who are creditors to other citizens. This remark, he says, can be extended to foreign nations. If the exclusive regulation of the value of coin was properly delegated to the federal authority, the policy of it equally requires a control on the states in cases above mentioned. So Madison is clearly explaining the same situation under the Articles of Confederation in America that is exactly happening here in Europe. Madison goes on to vice number five, a want of concert in matters where common interest requires it. How much has the national dignity, interest, and revenue suffered from this cause? What Madison is talking about here is the damage being done to the United States in conducting foreign policy because individual states under the Articles are free to engage in these kinds of financial activities, and we've got to stop it. His sixth vice, the want of guarantee to the states of their constitution and laws against internal violence. Because in some states, citizens took up arms, closed courts, harassed debt collectors, all the rest of it. And many of these states didn't feel that they had the power to prevent this, to control it. Remember Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts in 1787. So we need a government, Madison says, with the power to enforce the law. In number seven, he specifically talks about the want of sanction to the laws and of coercion in the government of the Confederacy. He says a sanction is essential to the idea of law as coercion is to that of government. Then he goes on in that same situation and he talks about the injustices of the laws of some states. And he points out that the causes of these injustices can be with the representative bodies, the legislatures, or it can be among the people themselves. And specifically, when he gets to the people themselves, he's talking about factions, groups of people who organize, debtors who organize to close courts and put pressure on the legislatures and all the rest of it. In other words, Madison, in his Vices of the Political System, is explaining to those who will attend the Philadelphia Convention why the Constitution is going to be so necessary, because it's going to prevent a lot of these things that are happening in the Confederation. It's very obvious, and if you read Krugman's article in this morning's New York Times, he and others are pointing out the same logical direction for Europe. It stands to reason, the logic seems to suggest, that the problems, financial problems, being created by the common currency, the euro, seem to warrant political unity, seem to warrant international control, the control of a body, of a government, of all of the members of the organization, all the members of the European Union. In other words, logic tends to suggest the flow of power from the local level to the central level, which was exactly the issue that the Constitution of the United States was debated over and fought over in the United States in 1787 and 1788. The issue of the location of power. If you're going to have a common currency, if you're going to manage it, if you're going to avoid a situation where you have some extremely poor nations and some absolutely incredibly wealthy nations, then you've got to have some power over them that is managing the situation so that you never get to that kind of an unfair situation. That, I would suggest to you, is the similarity between the Confederation and what's going on in Europe. So now the question confronts us. Why would a noted conservative spokesman like George Will, in the article that he wrote in the Washington Post last week on the Greek debt situation, why would George Will make it a point not only to criticize the euro, but more important, to criticize the European Union? George Will says, left-wing parties in other southern European countries besides Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, are watching to see if Greece can turn weakness, indeed prostration, into strength. Continue to rescue us, or we will collapse into a contagious mess. Actually, the risk of economic contagion is slight. Greece's economy is about the size of Louisiana's, Will says. 2% of the Eurozone's, and markets have discounted a Greek default. The real danger is a political contagion, flight from free market reforms elsewhere. What George Will is afraid of, and I have to believe, given his role, his prominence in conservative America today, that he's speaking for more than just himself. What George Will is most afraid of in the Greek situation is not the finances of it. Greek's finances are so small in relationship to the whole that it's insignificant. Again, notice, no consideration of the Greek people here. They don't even come to the table. That was the Pope's whole message. What worries George Will is that out of this kind of situation is going to come stronger political union. The European Union will be strengthened. And that's what he doesn't want. He said, it is said that the European Union is a splendid idea, but that the euro, the common currency, is a bad idea. Actually, Will said, the euro is a bad idea. That is the logical application of an even worse idea, the European Union. What George Will and other conservatives are most afraid of is the political centralization and power that's going to come out of this debt crisis. Think about conservative America's effort to reform the Constitution of the United States by amending the Constitution in order to return power to the states. Think of Koch Industries. Think of the American Legislative Exchange Council and its efforts to draw up conservative right-wing legislation in many states which Republicans have been able to gain control of in state legislatures. Think how close conservative America is to controlling the majority of the state legislatures in the United States. Think of how threatening that would be to the thought of Madison and Hamilton and the other founders to the calling of a constitutional convention. Think of the Liberty Amendments and the kinds of conservative changes that conservative America wants to make in the political structure of the United States. How they want to weaken the central government. How they want to take away lifetime appointments of Supreme Court judges. How they want to give state legislatures the opportunity to override court decisions they don't want or to override congressional laws that they don't support. In other words, the whole intent politically of conservatives is to weaken the power of the central government by returning to power to the states, which everything is indicating conservatives will control. That's where the Koch money is going. That's what the focus of the entire conservative movement politically in this country is all about, is to return power to the states in order to take it from the federal government. But the issue is not where the power is. The issue is who controls it once you get it there. Once power is successfully taken from the federal government and restored to the states, now the question comes, who's controlling power in the states? Think about the number of states that have elected Republican governors and Republican-controlled legislatures. Think of the extent to which the American Legislative Exchange Council and other conservative groups are calling the shots in these state legislatures. They are drafting legislation on right to work. They are drafting legislation on prevailing wage. They are drafting legislation to defeat Common Core standards. They are promoting legislation to basically keep certain ideas and textbooks and curriculum ideas out of our public schools. They are taking over control of the schools, taking over control of the economy, taking over control of the apparatus of state government. No wonder they want power restored to the states, because it gives them power. If you take that perspective and you lay it over the situation going on in Europe right now with the split between creditor and debtor nations and the logical movement towards more and more centralization of power in order to alleviate the problems in contemporary Europe, then what we are seeing, what we are witnessing in the Greece situation is the re-argument of the Constitution, of the ratification struggle for the Constitution of the United States here in this country. That's what we are seeing. And in George Will, we are seeing why conservatives don't want a stronger European Union. They want the individual states to remain independent. The reason they want the states to remain independent is the same reason that the anti-federalists in America in the 1780s wanted the states to remain independent of the central government. Namely, by keeping power close on the state level, it becomes easier for them to control it. It becomes easier for them to manipulate public opinion. It becomes easier for them to control elections. It becomes easier for them with decisions, Supreme Court decisions like Citizens United, to pump ungodly amounts of money into our campaign system to the point literally that you are buying office for compliant novice candidates who have no political legacy. There's nothing you can attack them on because they're all new. The only thing they are is beholden to those who have given them the money to get them elected. And they will vote the way they are told. And that's what the American Legislative Exchange Council is banking on. That's what Koch Industries is banking on. That's what these other conservative groups are banking on. And we see the same situation playing out in Europe. The difference is Europe created the common currency before they created the political unity. In this country, Madison and Hamilton and the rest of them were able to sell the Constitution and create the political unity first and use the need for the common currency as the justification for doing it. That seems to me to be the major difference. But it is a critically important difference. It seems to me this is critically important. It stands to reason, then, that if the situation in Europe promises to get worse without some sort of increased centralization of power, this is what the conservative victory in the recent elections in the United Kingdom is about. You'll remember that George Will quotes Margaret Thatcher, who was really worried about the European Union. In 1988, Margaret Thatcher said, "We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at the European, at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels." Margaret Thatcher was opposed to the European Union. She was opposed to the flow of power to the central, to the European Union, because it would cost the United Kingdom its independence and its flexibility, its financial flexibility. The people of the United Kingdom just voted the people of Great Britain just voted a conservative majority into Parliament. It is entirely likely that that conservative majority will eventually propose legislation to pull the mother, Great Britain, the mother country, out of the European Union. They never adopted the euro, and now it looks like they're reeling against the thoughts of the centralization of power in the hands of those who control decision-making of the European Union. I guess it's incumbent upon us to say this because the logic seems to suggest it. In the United States, if George Will is speaking for those conservative Americans who seek to diminish the power of the central government, and this is all of this is part of the attack on Obama, on Obamacare, on all of it. If they seek to weaken the power of the central government in order to return power to the states, then the question we have to ask ourselves is why? What benefit do they gain out of returning power from the central government to the states? And the answer to that question is obvious. They control the state legislatures. They can't get the White House, at least not yet. Their power has been accumulated by taking control of state legislatures one by one by one. And they've had the money, the private money to do it, and establishing all of these PACs, these political action committees, which make money available to their chosen candidates. They have taken power in the states. Their next step is to enhance the power of those states now that they have it. And in order to do that, they have to weaken the power of the central government. In Europe, the situation financially seems to call for some centralization and management of the economic situation throughout Europe. Europeans clearly see, the visionary human beings, the one that will allow themselves to think about it, clearly realize that you can't continue to have a European Union where half the members are debtor nations and the other half of them are creditor nations. Somebody has to manage this situation, just as the NFL has to manage the National Football League. The teams from Los Angeles and New England and New York and Atlanta, the biggest cities, the biggest populations, are making money. Dallas, for example. But the smaller markets, Minneapolis and Kansas City and St. Louis and those other places, they have to be able to field competitive teams, otherwise the success of the league will be affected. The only way to do it is for the National Football League to so manage the situation from the top that the wealthier franchises take care of the weaker, less wealthy franchises. The same kind of thing will pertain in Europe. The logic of this particular situation, fueled by the Greek bailout, is that somehow the centralization of power in Europe has to get control and manage this situation in order to keep future Greeces from happening. We're going to have to take from one and give it to the other. We're going to have to manage this with the idea that everybody wins. Who doesn't want that? Those that would receive or achieve power on the local level. Because basically, people of these nations, of the democracies, democratic nations, the implication of democracy is that the people ultimately control the government. At least they have the ability to be heard by government. But once decision-making leaves your government and goes to a national organization in Brussels, then the ability of the people to affect their political lives will be affected negatively. Democracy, the meaning of democracy will change because controlling their own government will no longer mean as much. In the United States, that's what Madison's changing definition of republicanism is all about. With the flow of power from the states under the Articles of Confederation to the central government, the ability of the people of the states was lessened. Somehow the people had to be convinced that democracy, republican government, could still work in America. And the establishment of the two-party system and the election campaign system that we know and love so much is the way it works. People are encouraged to vote, they're encouraged to come out and be heard, and all the rest of it. It looks like Europe is on the road to the same kind of decisions that we had made in this country 200 years ago. The people that opposed it then were the anti-federalists. The people that oppose it now are the George Wills. Because barring the change that seems to be happening, the people who control government are the Kochs, private corporations. Their ability to control government on the national level is difficult. Their ability to control it on the local level is much more manageable. Consequently, George Will and his conservative followers, those who agree with him, oppose the European Union because it creates a political apparatus that they can't get control of. Right now, the investors and the financiers and the creditors are calling the shots. If the European Union is strengthened, they won't be. So it's very obvious that George Will's position against the European Union is the same position he's taking in the United States in his opposition to the power of the central government under President Obama. And I think we have to look at it that way. It's 58 minutes after the hour. We have completed our 2 hours. I hope this made some sense. It's pretty complicated stuff, I know. I appreciate your willingness to tune in and hang in there with us. I hope you have a wonderful evening. I want to thank you for tuning in. I hope that you'll join us tomorrow. Remember that our Tuesday programs begin 1/2 hour later. We'll be beginning tomorrow in the East at 1:30 rather than 1 p.m. This is Bill O'Brien for the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Thank you so very much. We hope to see you again. Have a good evening.